Welcome to the 18th edition of News of the Church. It's the 7th of September, 2025, and it is the 13th Sunday after Pentecost. The old Roman martyrology informs us that today is the feast of Blessed Martyr John at Nicomedia, the birthday of Blessed Martyr John. Birthday, the dies natalis, refers to the day they're born into heaven. So, Blessed Martyr John, who seeing the cruel edicts against Christians posted up in the public square, no, this isn't the Diocese of Charlotte, and being inflamed with an ardent faith, stretched forth his hand and took them away and tore them up. It's not Detroit either, it's Nicomedia. This being reported to the emperors Diocletian and Maximian, you can substitute your own names, then residing in that city, they gave orders that he should be subjected to all kinds of torments, which the noble champion bore with such cheerfulness of spirit as not to show on his countenance the least trace of pain or grief. Well, perhaps some people of Detroit and Charlotte can invoke Blessed Martyr John. Now, a couple of years ago, I saw a movie called News of the World with Tom Hanks, who plays a former Confederate officer, and this is years after the Civil War. To eke out a living, he travels from town to town and reads aloud news stories from different newspapers. And so he lives as a gazetteer. Well, people were starved for news back then, and often they weren't very literate, so they were willing to pay a dime, 10 cents a head, to listen. That's about $2.50 today. The idea of a wandering gazetteer caught my imagination, and here I am making this recording for you. I get newsletters from various monastic communities in whom I have a great interest, and one of them, one of my favorite places, is in Gower, Missouri. I call it Gower Abbey. This is where the Benedictines of Mary, Queen of Apostles, are found. Their house is called Ephesus, and they have other foundations too. They have one in Evansville, Indiana, one in Ava, Missouri, and one in Colwich in the UK, in England. And they sent out a beautiful, beautifully printed newsletter, and it doesn't have a lot of, you know, chronicling in prose, but it has a lot of chronicling in photographs with brief captions, and a lot of photos too. It shows you what the sisters are up to. So here is the message in this newsletter. This is August 2025 from Mother Cecilia. And one of the things I should say before I say anything else is they have started to raise money through the sale of wine. And there can be, we can talk about that more later. I posted about it in the blog. Dear family, friends, and benefactors, we are a bit late in getting this summer newsletter out, but have certainly been keeping quite busy between our four houses. The biggest news to share is the happy completion of the renovations to the chapel at St. Anne's Monastery. In 6.5 months, the stark plain space was transformed into an absolutely magnificent gem, as you can see by the pictures. I wish I could squeeze the pictures in here. In God's providence, the chapel was finished just in time for the Feast of Saints Anne and Joachim on the 26th of July. Bishop Joseph Siegel blessed the renovated chapel with many lay people present, and the sisters' chaplain, Father Jambon, offered the Mass on the altar, which had been rescued and preserved from a closed church in Indiana. The sisters are happy and grateful indeed to take up the praises of God in this beautiful and worthy setting. Back in southern Missouri, the St. Joseph's Shrine at our Ava Priory is making good headway, with the sisters themselves chipping in as much as possible. We continue to work at reducing the monastery's debt before completing the interior of the church. Any assistance toward that end would be greatly appreciated. In England, one of the old cottages that served as a guest house was completely gutted and revamped into a pristine and clean temporary home for some of the sisters who feel the effects of the mold more severely. The others will take over the other cottage once work begins in the abbey itself, hopefully within the next 6 months. We will be facing some staggering bills for the work that is needed in restoring the historic edifice of St. Mary's at Colwich, but we place our confidence in Our Lady of Good Hope, as well as in her Son, in his loving providence. At Ephesus, as well as at all of our houses, the new candidates have begun to arrive. We rejoice to see an increase in vocations, dedicated young women offering their lives for Holy Mother Church and the salvation of souls. Quite a few of the sisters in formation are approaching their ceremonies in September and October, so please do keep them in your prayers. We will dedicate our next newsletter to their advancement in their various stages. In the meantime, please pray for us and know that we continue to pray daily for you and all your intentions. May God bless you in the hearts of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, Mother Cecilia, OSB. And so we have right here a picture of the sisters with some new chicks. And here's a shot of the bishop out here blessing the exterior of St. Anne's renovated chapel. And there are some photos of the interior with a priest saying a first mass and giving blessings. And here's a photo of a beautiful Corpus Christi procession. They've got a lovely canopy. First, the sisters make vestments, so you can expect that they would have some really splendid things for their own liturgical use. And so here's the priest carrying the Blessed Sacrament, and behind them along a stretched out line of the sisters at the St. Joseph Priory in Ava. Here they've made a carpet of flowers for Corpus Christi, and this is a great photo. At Ephesus, they're baling hay, and so they've got this tractor, of course, being driven by one of the sisters, and a long trailer on it, and they're piling up, they're stacking up big hay bales, and they're all in their habits and big floppy hats working on this. And there was a photo of them relaxing on a rooftop on one of the feast days, and they're having a cookout on the 4th of July. And then there's the blessing of St. Anne's Chapel. It's really lovely, with lots of beautiful, beautiful woodwork. And then we go to England, and they show where they've gutted this place out, and they're rebuilding it. And there's a picture of the sisters there with Bishop Athanasius Schneider. And then we go to the Ozarks at St. Joseph's. And good heavens, look at the size of this place. I suggest that you go to the website. It's benedictinesofmary.org, all one word, benedictinesofmary.org. And you should be able to pull up their newsletter and see some of these lovely photos. I get a newsletter from the Monastery of St. Benedict in France. The town is Brignoles, and Alcuin Reed is the prior there. It's not an abbey. This is for their newsletter for the time after Pentecost, so it's newsletter number 24. And it's called Nihil Operi Dei Preponatur, nothing is to be preferred or placed before the work of God. And of course, this refers to liturgy too. It starts out with a commentary on the election of Pope Leo XIV. And then it has a homily of the prior about the Feast of St. Benedict, and talking about the monastic life. And then we have some news from the place, which I'm sure that's really what you want to hear. Lent brought with its Ember Week retreat days. So this is a little dated, but that's okay. Things move slowly in monasteries. And we were delighted to welcome an abbot to guide us in our recollection. We are grateful to his community for releasing him. Holy Week saw a large contingent of guests who enabled its celebration to be worthy and beautiful. A newly restored repository for adoration on Thursday night and a correctly decorated cushion for the cross on Good Friday augmented the ceremonies, as did another beautifully hand-painted Paschal candle. Profound thanks to all who made these possible. Since March, we have been working steadily on a new edition of the Latin Breviarium Monasticum, last published in 1963, containing all the hours of the monastic office, with appendices adding many texts omitted in the 1963 edition, an enormous work, now in the final stages of production. Work on the Nocturnale Monasticum, containing all the chant for the singing of matins, continues. Volume 1, the Psalterium, is due for publication before the end of 2025. Further information and updates can be found on the Edition Pax Inter Spinas page of our website. The weather permitted our Corpus Christi procession and the picnic preceding it. A fortnight later, the land next to the clearing for the stational altar was ablaze. An accident on the autoroute, their interstate, set light to our property with the loss of around 6 hectares. We thank God for the professional action of the emergency services who rapidly brought the fire and a new outbreak a day later under control. A votive mass in honor of St. Barbara, patron of firefighters, was offered for their protection and in thanksgiving. The fire did not threaten the garden or our livestock. The garden is replete with growing birds hatched this year, laden fruit trees, honey-producing bees, and Nebbia, who is expecting her second litter of puppies. This year's garlic harvest was plentiful, and there are good prospects for the blackberries and pumpkins. The greenhouse provides mountains of tomatoes and other vegetables, and is proving to have been a truly worthy investment. Thanks again to all who contributed to building it. So, life at the Monastère Saint-Benoît goes ahead, goes forward. We wish them well. I'm looking at the August 28th edition of The Wanderer. The Wanderer is in its 158th year of publishing, so they've been around. And it's in my native place, St. Paul in Minneapolis. Wonderful people run it. Their website is a little deficient, but I think they're working on it. And they keep publishing a fine paper. Here in the opinion area of the page, I found an interesting piece by the esteemed Phil Lawler of CatholicCulture.com. Our Civilization's Death Wish by Phil Lawler. As the world's fertility rate plunges toward the replacement level, with every indication that it will continue dropping, the mainstream media have belatedly noticed the danger that lies behind that trend. It's bad for the economy. As we grow older, the workforce will shrink, since there won't be enough younger people replacing those who retire. That in turn means a shortage of active wage earners paying into the Social Security system to support the payments to their elders. More ominously, as we older people decline in health and need more care, there won't be enough young doctors and nurses to serve us. None of these problems should come as a surprise. In his 1987 book, The Birth Dearth, Ben Wattenberg predicted all of them. But in the U.S., at least, the crisis has been camouflaged by the arrival of immigrants in unprecedented numbers, providing a stopgap solution to the economic problem. But actually, the economic problem should be the least of our worries when we ponder the birth dearth, because a society that does not have children is a society heading for extinction, a civilization with a death wish. Significantly in the world today, the lowest fertility rates are found, generally speaking, in the most affluent countries. In other words, the societies that enjoy the greatest benefits from our global economic system are the ones that seem most intent on societal suicide. With the single exception of Israel, every wealthy country is now below the replacement level, in most cases by a substantial margin. What should this tell us? The societies at the top of the civilizational heap today are, more or less consciously now, arranging for that civilization's inevitable decline? Does our affluence inspire a death wish? Sociologists and zoologists and anthropologists and political theorists agree that the most basic drive in man or in any other animal is the instinct for self-preservation. We all want to live, of course, but beyond that, we want to preserve our species. At times, in fact, the urge to protect future generations overpowers the instinct for self-protection. Parents sacrifice their lives to save their children. Something different is happening in our society. Notice how the dangers of the birth dearth are expressed first in terms of how it will harm us, the older people, who may not have enough help to guarantee a comfortable retirement. We may give some thought to how depopulation will impoverish our own children, but we rarely think of their children, of the great-great-great-grandchildren we will never see. This, too, is a new development, I think. In the past, adults thought of themselves as links in a chain that stretch backward and forward across countless generations. Think of the lords of the European nobility, who saw it as their duty to pass along the family's estate, intact, if not improved, to future generations. Those aristocrats had a desire to preserve not only themselves, but their families, not only their wealth, but their way of life. In the small New England town where I live, there are tracts of open land, and from time to time a developer proposes to build on them. Immediately, some of the town's residents suggest that the site would be ideal for housing for the elderly, or a subdivision restricted to owners over 55, or perhaps for small starter homes for newlyweds. The point is that any such development would bring in new homeowners, new taxpayers, to ease the burden on current residents, but no new children. Children, you see, are a burden, because most children would go to the public schools, and with the annual cost per student headed toward $20,000, a new family that arrives in town with three or four school-aged children will not pay nearly enough in property taxes to offset the educational costs. You might question at this point why public school costs are so high. Indeed, that question is raised quite frequently at our annual town meetings, but then someone stands up and says, "It's for our children," and any resistance to the soaring educational costs evaporates. No one dares to suggest that we as a community do not care about our children. We dote on our children. We want what's best for them, but we don't want any more children. And paradoxically, that may be what would be best for them and all of us. Thus, Phil Lawler on our civilization's death wish. They seem to have rented teeth and tongue today. Tongue's going to get stumbling all over words, but I hope you'll be patient with me. Let's see what else the Wanderer can turn up for us. Here we have in the September 4th edition of The Wanderer, on the front page, Christopher Mannion has a provocative little piece here. Should our bishops ban the Spanish Mass? America's bishops today face a challenge that is as old as the country itself. It's called assimilation. But yet, we seldom hear them mention that word. Why not, I wonder? After all, Pope Francis espoused it in his famous motu proprio Traditionis Custodes, where he speaks of our bishops as guardians of the tradition. The bishops, in communion with the Bishop of Rome, constitute the visible principle and foundation of the unity of their particular churches under the guidance of the Holy Spirit through the proclamation of the gospel, and by the means of the celebration of the Eucharist, they govern the particular churches entrusted to them. In order to promote the concord and unity of the Church. Pope Francis' apostolic letter issued motu proprio was released on 16th of July 2021, and it's had a tumultuous 4 years. But hasn't our nation's search for unity experienced a tumultuous 400 years? Concord and unity, you know, a pluribus unum and all that. Well, everybody seems to be for unity these days. All are welcome, boast the websites and the bulletins of countless parishes throughout the country. Any of these unifying messages entail an invitation not only to all sinners, but to several special categories as well. You know, like the divorced and remarried, active homosexuals, and supporters of abortion rights. But whatever it means, unity is in big time. Examples abound. Like this one from Bishop Mario E. Dorsonville, Auxiliary Bishop of Washington and Chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration in 2020. As a founding principle of our country, we have always welcomed immigrant and refugee populations, and through the social services and good works of the church, we have accompanied our brothers and sisters in integrating to daily American life. But how can immigrants and refugees achieve that unity? Why the definitions? Because words matter. That was a subtitle. Why the definitions? Because words matter. The Catechism of the Catholic Church answers that question by emphasizing the duties of both citizens and aliens, and the language is precise. Quote, "The more prosperous nations are obliged, to the extent they are able, to welcome the foreigner in search of the security and means of the livelihood which he cannot find in his country of origin. Public authorities should see to it that the natural right is respected that places a guest under the protection of those who receive him." Close quote. Catholic Catechism, this is paragraph 2241, subsection 1. Note the term foreigner. Notice also that we are not talking about the Holy Family here. While our shepherds often invoke the flight into Egypt to justify their embrace of illegal aliens, one must correct them gently, lest they base their argument on errors of fact. The Roman Empire effectively conquered Egypt in 30 BC after the defeat of Cleopatra VII and Mark Antony by Octavian at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. Egypt was annexed as a Roman province the following year. So Jesus, Mary, and Joseph were not foreigners. They were Roman subjects. Hint, remember the census in the second chapter of St. Luke's Gospel? Moreover, they were fleeing danger to escape the killers Herod sent, the same way and just as legally as folks fleeing Minnesota today to escape the lawless region of Governor Tim Walz. Beyond that, we note that the foreigner is a guest. What was it that Winston Churchill said about a house guest? Like a fish on the beach, he shines, but after 3 days he smells. Churchill is blunt. The guest is here with our permission. If he misbehaves or overstays his welcome, we tell him to leave. Moreover, the decision to welcome the immigrant is a prudential one, to be taken by public authorities who in turn are enforcing the law. That is why, even though our bishops approve of illegal aliens who violate immigration law, the USCCB has long condemned our broken immigration system, avoiding the fact that they mean they don't like our immigration laws because their beloved illegals have all broken them. That is why El Paso's bishop, Mark J. Seitz, condemned 10 state government officials who supported the rule of law as hypocrites and Pharisees in an article published nationally by USA Today 8 years ago. Bishop Seitz has never apologized, and, by the way, while he apparently refuses to follow Canon 915 regarding pro-abortion public officials residing in his diocese, we should not call him a Pharisee, although we might quietly pray that he will someday enforce canon law. If you can break one law, you may as well break the rest, as an old boss of mine used to say. Back to the Catechism of the Catholic Church 2241. Where next comes the foreigner's search for the security and means of livelihood which he cannot find in his country of origin. A conservative estimate would reckon that some 8 billion people in the world, over 5 billion, would prefer the peace and means of livelihood experienced by folks in the United States to that which they experience in their home country. That is why the Catechism specifies that nations can use their prudential judgment to conceive and execute laws specifically the extent they are able to welcome the foreigner. Our bishops never tell us how many they want us to let in, we've asked, but we can't take in all 5 billion, whether they like it or not. What about immigration law? For decades, our bishops have advocated changing it, so they recognize it's the law, or they wouldn't bother. In the meantime, however, since their proposed changes have not been adopted, they simply continue to advocate breaking it. Not all aliens are immigrants, a distinction religiously avoided by our bishops. But once an alien is permitted to immigrate, his duties are spelled out in the second paragraph of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, 2241. Quote, "Political authorities, for the sake of the common good for which they are responsible, may make the exercise of the right to immigrate subject to various judicial conditions, especially with regard to the immigrant's duty toward their country of adoption. Immigrants are obliged to respect with gratitude the material and spiritual heritage of the country that receives them, to obey its laws, and to assist in carrying civic burdens. Juridical conditions, immigrants' duties, respect, gratitude, heritage, laws. Enough! Our shepherds find such language to be oppressive, divisive, and offensive. It bespeaks white privilege. Excuse me. White privilege. He comes back and he spells it with capital letters. You know, capital W, capital P, in brackets. The Mannion has a style that reads better on print, in print, than it reads all loud. It's actually kind of hard to read this. But anyway, I've gotten to another subtitle. And this one brings us back to the whole liturgical thing, which is why I started in the first place. The thing about immigration is interesting, but my point was, I think, the wry humor in about the Mass. But here we go. A modest proposal. Now, you'll recognize that from, was it Jonathan Swift, I think? When you see A Modest Proposal, it's a reference to the work by highly satirical, biting work by Jonathan Swift in the 18th century, where he's mocking the way people treat the poor and the poor population and so forth. So he suggests that maybe, you know, we could solve some of our problems just simply by eating them. And so A Modest Proposal is used by lots of people. Let's get back to the wanderer. A Modest Proposal. Our bishops are never going to help immigrants assimilate if they won't even follow the rules of their own catechism, much less the law of the land. But let's take the bishops at their word, prayerfully and carefully, of course, in their search for unity and ours. The traditional Latin Mass has been deemed divisive. In the name of unity, the TLM will soon be all but extinct. The faithful will finally be able to worship at the same Mass. But wait! One more step is required to achieve solidarity in our unity, and in making this decision, they don't have to ask Rome. In all matters concerning the liturgy, canon law confers total authority on the bishops. Perhaps the time has come. In the name of unity, should our bishops ban the Spanish Mass in the United States? In calling on immigrants to seek unity, the Catechism calls on them to respect with gratitude the material and spiritual heritage of the country that receives them, to obey its laws, and to assist in carrying civic burdens. Shouldn't that include learning our language? Our bishops answer, no. In fact, many of our bishops seem determined to put our nation's heritage behind us. The sooner the better. Wait a minute. What about gratitude? Forget it. This attitude has caused such division that Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez has proudly hailed the next America as a Hispanic one. Your Excellency, how do you expect that notion to unify the faithful? Stay tuned. Well, that was wide-ranging, and surely will be very popular in the offices of the USCCB. I really started to read that because of the wonderful irony in the idea that for the sake of unity, now bishops who ban the older form of Mass, the traditional Latin Mass, should also ban Spanish. I mean, after all, shouldn't we all be worshiping together? But no, wait, even English favors some. Spanish favors another. Korean or Latvian or whatever other language we are going to have is going to favor those groups. Oh, maybe the best way to do it would be to have a Mass which is like a mishmash of languages, you know, like moving from one to another. But no, that doesn't really work either. If only the Church had a common tongue that could bring us together, not only that wouldn't favor necessarily a specific group of people, but perhaps could unite us across nations and maybe even generations as well. Perhaps we should give that some thought. And here is something completely different from the September 11th edition of The Wanderer by Gaetano Masciullo. Miracle in Naples. Saint's blood liquefies in August for the first time since 1389. The blood of St. Januarius liquefied on August 25th at 5:50 p.m. in an exceptional occurrence after the relic had been exposed for veneration at the opening of the National Liturgical Week gathering here. This was a rare event. The last time the blood liquefied in August was more than 600 years ago in 1389. The people of Naples welcomed this sign as a special blessing on the church and the world. At the moment the reliquary containing the saint's relics was brought out, the blood appeared completely liquid, declared Vincenzo de Gregorio, abbot of the Chapel of the Treasure. The blood of St. Januarius is a traditional Catholic relic deeply cherished by the people of Naples. It consists of two small glass vials containing the blood of the bishop who is the city's patron saint and was martyred in the 3rd century during the persecutions under Emperor Diocletian. Each year, the relic is publicly displayed for veneration by the faithful on 3 occasions, September 19th, the memorial of the patron saint, the Saturday before the first Sunday of May, commemorating the transfer of the saint's relics, and December 16th, in memory of the miracle attributed to the saint who protected the city during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. During these liturgical occasions, there's been a lot of volcanic activity around the Bay of Naples area. Coincidence? I don't know. During these liturgical occasions, the faithful of Naples await with trepidation the liquefaction of the blood, that is, the transition from solid to liquid. When this occurs, the Christian people receive the event as a sign of a special divine blessing upon the entire community. In certain cases, the blood of St. Januarius liquefies in completely exceptional circumstances. This year, it was decided to display the relic at the opening of the 75th National Liturgical Week. This is an annual gathering organized by the Italian Episcopal Conference, where priests, theologians, religious, and lay people come together to reflect on how to make the liturgy more understandable and participatory for the faithful. Oh. It was the first time for the event to be held in Naples, and among the officials present was Vatican Secretary of State Pietro Cardinal Parolin. When the abbot responsible for the exposition retrieved the relic, he was reportedly astonished to find that it already liquefied. The reliquary was then offered to Cardinal Parolin for veneration, and he kissed it. Dominican Cardinal Battaglia, Archbishop of Naples, subsequently displayed the reliquary to the faithful, who greeted the event with long and thunderous applause. Pope Leo XIV sent a personal message of good wishes to Catanzaro Archbishop Claudio Maniago, president of the Center for Liturgical Action that organized the event. Quote, "The liturgical week offers me the opportunity to express deep appreciation to all those in the Italian Church who devote themselves to the liturgical animation of the people of God, called, through the diversity of roles and ministries, to give praise to the Lord," the Pope said. Pope Leo also expressed the hope that these days, quote, "may foster an increasingly active participation of the faithful in the Church's liturgical action, awakening a renewed awareness of the evangelizing nature of sacred celebrations. May the symposium encourage reflection and the development of practical pastoral guidelines, so that the faithful may rediscover churches as places of worship, where faith is celebrated, the Lord is encountered, present and active in the sacraments, and fraternal communion is lived." The theme of this year's liturgical week was hope. For this reason, Cardinal Parolin recalled that, quote, "there is a need for hope, not only for Naples but for the world, because today we truly lack many elements that help us to hope, especially at the international level, due to the difficulty in initiating a path towards peace in situations of conflict. Therefore, we must not give in to resignation, but continue to work for peace and reconciliation." And of course, hope. Referring to the miraculous liquefaction of the blood of St. Januarius, Parolin added that, "we also need the intercession of the saints to obtain peace in the world." Cardinal Battaglia also recalled that, quote, "in this time marked by materialism and individualism, the liturgy teaches us the art of pausing and learning to resist the temptation of hopeless resignation. Our brothers and sisters who celebrate and pray among the ruins of Gaza, as well as those who sing amid the deafening sirens that fill the skies and monasteries of Ukrainian cities and all countries devastated by war, teach us this well." Thus, an article by Gaetano Masciullo. And that's my phone. Well, that's the second thing I've read that had, shall we say, something really interesting, sandwiching something that wasn't all that interesting. But, you know, not all news in a newspaper is good, right? I see that I'm over a half hour of recording now, and I think I'll just wrap it up there. Not perhaps the most electrifying edition of News of the Church. Maybe the next one will have like more stuff about space and chess. I know that's the stuff that you really want to hear. So anyway, thank you for your attention, and please pray for me as I will for you.